A blessed day here at the Art of Flying podcast. I appreciate everyone's patience waiting for this episode, but I assure it will have been worth it. Today, our guest is Billy Keenan, who will explain what he does a little bit when he gets into his first monologue here. I want to thank Billy for joining us today. And first, I'd like to ask, where can listeners find you online?
I'm online at billykeenanspeaks.org. That's all one word, BillyKeenanSpeaks.org, BillyKeenanSpeaks.org.
Thanks, Bill. And I also know he has a Facebook page, which you guys should tune into, and keep an eye out on YouTube for things coming in the near future. Billy, can you tell me a little bit what you do and what your purpose is?
Well, I retired from teaching in June of 2017. And after that, I thought, what's my next act? And I've come through so much, as the podcast will probably reveal. But I realized that I had this incredible story to tell and an obligation to go do it and not keep it to myself. So I started out going out as, for lack of a better term, a motivational speaker in September of 2017. And I started very humbly with 20 12th graders. And I just talked about my life experiences, and they're varied. And then what brought me to it was spinal cord injury, my survival, my rehab and recovery, and then really coming back to life.
Awesome. Thank you. Now, I want to dive a little deeper into that. What is your history as Billy Keenan the human? Tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you've experienced. And I've heard you use a couple of key terms.
Yes.
That kind of goes over the timeline. I'd maybe start with that and then go into those stories individually.
All right. I was a high school soccer star, and very interesting. I consider myself only an athlete, but I grew up in a traditional Irish household. And my dad was an NYPD detective, but played Irish traditional accordion and sang. So I grew up playing traditional Irish music and then added guitar and electric bass and piano. And my mom got a hold of me before junior year, and she said, "You're not making the most of your talents. When the school play comes up, you're going to audition." And I said, "Mama, I'm a soccer player. I don't do drama. Drama people do drama." And she said, "It is an insult to God to not use your God-given ability." So when she threw God at me, God plus the other G word, guilt. Mm-hmm. So I auditioned and got the lead part in Fiddler on the Roof. And I got seven of my soccer teammates to come in with me. And I got the lead part. And they did a song and dance number, and it was a phenomenal success. So from that, I threw my hat in the ring for student council president, and I got elected. And that brought me to a whole wide array of opportunities. And the one that really called out to me, and I felt it was truly a vocation, was the calling to serve as a lieutenant in the United States Army. So I accepted an ROTC scholarship from Fordham University. So what that meant was that the Army picked up the dime for my college tuition. And every Wednesday, I'd get home from lunch to my dorm, put on Army camouflage and combat boots, and go for 3 hours of military science classes and then field training exercises 1 weekend a month. And then 6 weeks every summer, I'd fly away to places like Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Fort Knox, Kentucky, for intensive military training. And then at the end of May, graduation 1989, the night before commencement, I was commissioned a second lieutenant, went to and graduated from the U.S. Army Airborne School at Fort Benning, Georgia, where I became a paratrooper and learned the beautiful art of jumping out of perfectly good airplanes. From there, I traveled back to New York, spent a week with mom and dad, hopped in the car, drove from New York to Seattle, Washington, where I was stationed for 2.5 years. I got my first platoon, 30 soldiers, and they put you where you can do the least amount of damage as a young second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was doing really well. And my battalion commander said, you know, Bill, the soldiers seem to follow you out of curiosity, which I thought was kind of a backhanded compliment. But those 2.5 years flew by, and I found myself occupying a desk job for a battalion staff, producing every day, crunching numbers and producing briefing slides for captains and majors. And it was like a death trap. So my wanderlust got the better of me. And I put in for an assignment to take me to Honduras for 6 months to become a company executive officer, which is like the right-hand man for a captain who's the commander. But knowing my luck, I got there, and 1 week into my tour of duty, the captain got sick, and I ended up, at the age of 24, in command of 100 soldiers. But it was an amazing experience, because our mission was what they called the low-intensity conflict, and I had no idea what that meant. So I started asking some of my brother lieutenants, and nobody could really figure it out. And we got together over a couple of adult beverages, and then we realized what it was. Low intensity conflict. It's another word for Cold War, except that the Cold War was over. Mm-hmm. This is 1992, so we weren't calling it that anymore. But we were there to be a presence in Central America so that they would not revert to a single party Marxist dictatorship. And what that meant every day was that you go out and help people and show them that, hey, democracy, capitalism, free market economy, and, you know, just liberty, government for the people, by the people, of the people, is the way to go. So when your job every day is to go out and help people, it's like completely rewarding. But then I had a choice. Stay in the military, be promoted to captain, and move on and spend another 8 years. It's basically at a staff job with only 1 year of command. And I decided to get out and come home. Came home, started a band. Quickly, we were playing 100 dates a year. 50 of those were weddings. I went to grad school, became a teacher, got married, had 2 kids, and basically built my life. At some point in the early 2000s, I was getting a dad bod, so I started triathloning, which I continued from the year 2000 to 2013. And I started surfing in 2003, and it was a carpe diem moment. I was at my family's beach house in Ocean City, New Jersey, and my dad was in the last year of an epic fight with medullary thyroid cancer. And I looked at him, struggling and weak, and I thought, you know what? I heard those words from the Robin Williams movie, Dead Poets Society. Carpe diem. Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. And I said, what's on my bucket list? And it was surfing. I think I might have just seen the movie Endless Summer. So I went up to the boardwalk, plunked down my $40, and found myself in a surf class with a bunch of sugared up 9-year-olds. And I was like the only adult there. And I looked like Buddy the Elf, you know, the Will Ferrell movie. Yep. And big fan. But I caught that first wave, and to feel the pull, the power of the ocean when you paddle and it takes the board, and before you know it, you're up and riding. That is just pure exhilaration, of which the only thing that quite compares to it is jumping out of an airplane, you know? So it's just this amazing thing. So I carried on with my teaching and triathloning, playing music every weekend, spending time with my growing boys. And then September 14th of 2013, I went surfing in Seagirt, New Jersey, and I was up and riding on a beautiful 3-foot wave. And before I knew it, the water that I was riding got sucked out, and I found myself in a free fall. My head hit the sand in 2 feet of water, and I was instantly paralyzed. My last conscious memory is of trying to stand, and then everything faded to black. And there was one surfer in the water. He saw me come to the surface, face down, and he dragged me out of the water, started CPR. The EMTs arrived. I was defibrillated twice. So I was flatlined, defibrillated twice, taken to the hospital, diagnosed C4 quad, multiple incomplete fractures on my cervical spine, placed in a halo, trached, vented, put on fentanyl, put in a 2.5 week coma. And then I woke up to the darkest night of the soul. And there I was moved to Helen Hayes Hospital, where I began rehab. And that was the beginning of this journey.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I've heard parts of that story before, but not vivid details like Bill just provided. So guys, if you get a chance, really listen back to how much life was lived in that short amount of time, and you're going to see how much life he's living now. And I want to say inspiring life to be lived in others, everybody he speaks to and touches in a way. And also a little side note, interestingly, because we don't want it just to be about the misery of the trauma and the accident. This is about the knowledge or wisdom that we've extracted since. And coming to Bill's place today, I actually had to pass and get off the exit of the same place where I was laying dead about 15, 16 years ago. So that was just an interesting, I don't want to say ironic, but almost synchronistic entrance to this place today and to this interview, which at the same time, a moment later, I got to remember playing elite soccer, just as Bill had, at Rockland Community College. They have this big indoor stadium full of basketball courts, and that was our winter field. So as I passed this place where I had experienced the most trauma I had ever imagined experiencing in my life and more, then immediately after I passed a place that brought me pure joy and a memory of being at my best. So it's, I don't know what point I'm trying to make here, but just that we have so many experiences in life. To dwell on the one thing that seems traumatic would be almost silly and trivial, because we've experienced so much other good, and so many things in this world can remind us of that. And yeah, so I'm going to transition to the first question, and thank you, Billy, for sharing your story. Yeah. My first question to all the guests is, what is heaven to you?
Heaven. Heaven is a beautiful moment of transition, of transformation. That's a much better word. Where I am lifted out of this wheelchair, and because I'm a Christian, I am welcomed with open arms into an embrace from my Savior. And the words he says to me are, "Suffer no more. Your suffering is over. Be happy forever in my kingdom." And what that kingdom, what that heaven looks like for me is 3 to 5 foot waves, warm water about 80 degrees, and I surf all day long with beautiful offshore breezes. And at the end of every day, as the sun's going down, I sit on the beach with my Father, and in between us are a cooler full of beer, and he's got his accordion, and I've got my guitar, and that's how we spend our nights. Days surfing and nights of music, and it just goes on forever, and that's my heaven.
Beautiful. Thank you. I would say my heaven is something similar with my father and all those that I know are around and guiding and assisting. Yeah. And again, saying that, I feel like I've heard that in my unconscious or my dream state, that statement that you said is suffer no more.
Yeah.
And yeah, beautiful. Thank you. Well said. From a very enlightened man, have you ever felt enlightened or enlightenment, Bill? If so, please describe.
All right. So I taught global history, 9th and 10th grade. And in 9th grade, I taught comparative religion. So I was always a great fan of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. And there are times, every time I taught it, I used to love to go over the Four Noble Truths. You know, all of life is full of suffering. The reason we suffer is because of desire. To get rid of suffering, we must get rid of our desire. And to get rid of our desire, we have to follow the Eightfold Path. And that's the hard part, the Noble Eightfold Path. And that is right aspiration, right labor, right this, right that. And it's a whole laundry list of things to do to achieve enlightenment. And enlightenment, as laid out, and of course, I'm paraphrasing and leaving a lot out, is the state of wanting nothing. And it's funny, I'm not at that place where I want nothing. And I don't know that I ever will be, because what I want more than anything is the gift of more time. Because now that I've found my purpose to go out and speak and to inspire and to help people with their suffering, all I want is more time to be able to continue doing that. And I don't think that I'll ever achieve that place of wanting nothing. And the other part is that because I was abandoned by my wife after my injury, there is an emptiness, a place where the whole foundation of love and relationship that you thought was there, that foundation that you thought was built on concrete, turns out to have been built on sand. And when the tempest came, the whole house blew away. And so for me, there are hours in the day where I'm alone that should be filled with family and wife and children. And those are the difficult hours for me, from like 5 to maybe 8 p.m. And there's always that emptiness that will always be there that I don't think will ever truly be filled. But the best way for me to fill it is to go out and give the one thing that I have left of value to the world. And that's my story.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill. And thank you for sharing that. And that was a great perspective. Maybe one of the first people in these interviews to quote the Buddha so directly. So thank you for that.
Yeah, man.
Right after proclaiming how Christian you are. So that was pretty cool. Thank you. And I just want to throw this out there because I've studied one of the biggest meditations that has helped me since my accident and figuring out what was going on in reality and intrinsically in my brain and my mind. Was a nothing meditation or a no-thing meditation, and you mentioned to want nothing. Some would see that as wanting no physical thing, but like I see nothing as an actual thing, as a state of consciousness or awareness, almost like being silent, that's an attainment at a certain point, because we as humans, we want to talk so much, we want to communicate, and we want to move. To be silent is a form of mastery. To have nothing, or to want nothing, is a state of mastery as well. As you said, but nothing is simply no thing, but in itself it is a thing, it's a state, it's a mental concept. So it's very interesting because that is almost an emptiness at the same time. And you were speaking of emptiness as lack, but yeah. I might shift your perspective a little bit now and say that it is everything, right?
Wow.
Because the universe, yeah. The Big Bang, God said, let there be light. There was nothing at first. So that's the pure state of existence before all this chaos yeah. started and us trying to find our way back. So maybe that would help a little bit. That emptiness you feel is actually the nothing that you want.
Wow. You know, it's something just bouncing off what you just said. There is a great quote from Dr. Wayne Dyer. He, a writer and thinker who did numerous PBS specials, and he did one about the writing of Lao Tzu, and he has this great quote, and Dr. Wayne Dyer passed away just a few years ago, and I was desperately grieved over his passing because he had such a deep effect on my life. But he said, and I used to use this with my students all the time, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Mm-hmm. So for you to just say what you just said has now got me, and long after you leave this afternoon, I'll be sitting in my recliner thinking about that, you know, because mm-hmm. that really is a totally different perspective of the emptiness that I feel.
Mm-hmm. And it's that human wanting of the grass is greener on the other side. So that emptiness you feel feels like that's not what you want. But there were certain times, what if, you know, it was going chaotic with the kids and wife was in the kitchen yelling about all this stuff. Wouldn't that emptiness and that silence be exactly what you were looking for?
Right? Every
now and again, right? Thank you. A question that's important to me that we've received a lot of different feedback about. I don't see anything as good or bad. I just see different perspectives speaking up about things in the current state of the world. Do you feel that we can build a utopia here?
Wow. You know, this is where hope would have to triumph completely over experience. There was, during the Industrial Revolution, there was a man named Robert Owen who was a very wealthy businessman. And this is at a time of great upheaval where the workers were just being abused by the factory owners and the real men with capital, money to invest, were paying. You know, the workers had horrible conditions, horrible unsafe conditions, low wages, long hours, just decrepit. And this man, Robert Owen, built a community around a factory in New Lanark, Scotland. And he was a utopian industrialist. And what he created was a factory, and all the workers, he built housing, like adequate housing for the workers and their families. He built schools in the community for the children. He introduced safety and lower hours and a livable wage. And wouldn't you know it, he still made a profit, right? And he was a utopian industrialist. So with that as my guide, I would say yes, it is possible. But the state of the world that we live in right now, the state of pure chaos, where the top 1% are living such disparate lives, such disconnect from those of us that muddle around, like myself, on Medicaid and Social Security disability insurance and struggling to pay the bills, there is such a disconnect. And I don't know if we can shift the paradigm to create something closer to a utopia. Because I'm not for robbing all from the rich to give to the poor. I think the thing that made this country so great is the opportunity that you could come here with nothing and by the sweat of your brow, create opportunity that would lift you and your whole family up to the next socioeconomic level. Because I can tell you, Tobin, that my grandfather came here from the west of Ireland with nothing. 2 years after he came here, he was drafted into the United States Army. And 1 year after that, he was dodging bullets in France in the last days of World War I. Came back to America, married a woman also from Ireland. They had 10 children, one of whom was my father. 5 of his 6 sons served in the military. There was no money for college, but my dad joined the NYPD after he left the Army after a 2-year enlistment and started taking night classes at Rockland Community College, got his associates, and then went to Mercy College and got his bachelor's and went 27 credits into his master's degree. My mom was a secretary. We were the middle of the middle class. So when I was commissioned as lieutenant, that was the first time in 3 generations of military service that we produced a commissioned officer. My younger brother John followed me 2 years later when he graduated from West Point. The house that I grew up in, I could fit in a corner of this house. Mm. So each level, each generation of my family improved one after the other, but by the sweat of our own brow. In my case, I worked teaching history 5 days a week and playing music every weekend. I was hustling to create this life for my family, you know? And so to me, being the middle of the middle class is perfect. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. If we could create that and call it utopia, I'm all for it.
Agreed. Yeah. So point with what Bill just said is that although the world right now is in a place of such disconnect between the shakers and movers of everything that we're doing down here on the 99 below level, and maybe the apathy of the rest of us in not thinking that we can change it. What Bill just explained in a great example, in a real life, cohesive, coherable, whatever it is, all of those words, concept is that with time and hard work, we can create that utopia. And it's going to take, you know, a lot of work for little strides generationally, but within 3 generations, we can completely turn around what we thought was our destiny or our place in this world. And to jump back a few more minutes, Bill said that this world right now is such an advanced state of chaos. Now, I study a lot of the quantum world, and I'm sure some of you are interested in it as well. And what scientists have realized is that what we think is chaos on this level of randomization in the quantum realm, all it takes is a directed thought, and that chaos organizes itself into the most complex order that forms cells from the micro level all the way up. And that's how life forms in this universe, is that there is all this chaotic, fluxing, subatomic energy out there. But when our human consciousness or our consciousness that was gifted through free will through the Creator starts to conceptualize something, all of that chaos starts to organize itself into physical matter so that we can manifest a reality. That said, with all this chaos in the world right now, all that is potential energy that we need to consciously direct towards a certain purpose and a goal, and then everything can change very quickly.
Awesome, man.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah.
Thank you. You led to that. That's just my revelation of your statement. My favorite question, because of my namesake, and I'm interested to hear yours, both physically and symbolically. What does flying mean to you?
Flying. Flying to me is catching a wave at a place at a little town called Rincon in Puerto Rico, right in front of a hotel called Casa de Elena. And there's a little spot and there's a parking lot. So the spot is literally called Parking Lots. And back in 2010, I went to Rincon with the woman I was married to. And I rented a 10-foot longboard and walked down to Parking Lots and paddled out. And there were a couple of people in the water, and there were waves that just kept coming like a conveyor belt. And the freedom and the exhilaration of riding those waves is my definition of flying, because there's nothing like that umbilical pull of the wave and the momentum when you pop up and you're pumping your legs down the line to stay with the wave before it closes out. That is flying. And then, of course, at airborne school, when there's 64 guys in an airplane and you jump out in groups of 10 or 12. And airborne school is in Georgia, but the drop zone is just over the state line into Alabama. So you fly around for an hour or two so the pilots can get more stick time. And the first time I jumped, there were guys like, it was the domino effect of vomiting. Everybody was nervous and they were barfing up their lunch or their breakfast. And I didn't, I actually took a nap. And we got a command from the jump master, 6 minutes. And then your heart starts to pound a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then it's 3 minutes, and then 2 minutes, 1 minute. And then the jump master screams, stand up, to the first 10 guys. And when you're a commissioned officer, you're the ranking guy in your stick of 10 jumpers. So guess what? You have to go out first. Mm-hmm. So the jump master looked at me and said, stand in the door. So I hooked up my D-ring that held the ripcord to the static line, and I edged closer and closer to the open door of the aircraft, which was the C-130, a prop plane. And I put my left hand outside the door and my right hand outside the door, and my toes, my left foot in front of my right on the edge of the doorway. And then I heard the words screamed, go, and a SWAT on my backside. And there's no hesitation, you have to go. And I threw myself out. And when you jump static line, you know, they don't let you do free fall where you pull the ripcord. Army jumping is, most army jumping is with a static line, and that pulls the ripcord. Special ops, special forces, SEALs, and Force Recon Marines do high jumping that requires them to pull the ripcord. So I jumped out, and your instructions are to count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, and you feel a sharp tug. And you look up and you see a beautiful full canopy of a parachute wide open. If you look up and there's a tangle in your chute, you have 2 seconds to pull your ripcord on your reserve to save your life and to save your legs. And so that's the training. So every time I jumped, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, and then open chute, and then the flying comes in, and you can hear nothing. And you just see, you look to your left and right, and you see other guys, like you can't hear them, but everybody's screaming. And then you jump from 1,500 feet. So it's a very quick ride. And once you're at treetop level, you got to prepare to land. So the flight is a quick one, but that feels like flying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Jumping.
I'm glad you cycled around to that, because that's what I thought you were going to do first, but you went into the surfing, which is very symbolic, because that's where Bill experienced his accident, his trauma, and his transformation, and his life shift, and getting into that dark night of the soul so that he could find that pure, true light that was going to guide him from there on. But the parachuting is an interesting thing. If you guys are listening to this, you know who you're listening to. I go by Flying Tobin, and that's a name that was given to me. I've actually never gone skydiving or parachuted in my life, because I've always had this abnormal idea that I'm going to start going up, and our species is destined for that at some point. But in recent months, and I haven't really told anybody this, I've wanted to go skydiving, and I've wanted to get into this, and I've wanted to start doing it professionally, personally, not like as a career, but doing it so regularly that people see me as a skydiver, and maybe wearing the wingsuit, and maybe doing parasailing and things like that, or who knows, kiteboarding down in the ocean is a very cool thing, because you're kind of, it's like half surfing, half parachuting or parasailing. Yeah, so that's very inspiring. Somebody I care about very much was going through some depression and anxiety and just some life transitory stuff. And I recently saw she went skydiving, and I was really, really happy to see that, because it means she's getting herself out there. She's living life, and it inspired me to do so. And mark my words, you will see within a couple of months of this recording being posted that I will be posting my skydiving experiences, because Bill has inspired me thoroughly. I've never known anybody who hasn't done it just for leisure or fun, going with somebody tandem with them and then doing it a few times on their own. Bill did it because he was aiming to save lives and protect our liberty in the future, and that's so admirable that it's inspiring me to really go do this. So I'm going to go home today and try to sign up for skydiving, just so you guys know. Flying to me has always meant doing things that nobody else thought you could do, and to find yourself intrinsically or in the heart of the matter flying through life, and just people not knowing how you're doing it, but it doesn't matter. An eagle doesn't look around at chipmunks saying, "How's this guy flying?" It just flies, and it soars higher and higher, and that's its native reality. That's always how I've seen it symbolically. So to me, it's when dreams start to come true, or things that I've set in my mind, I want to do this. When I was 11 years old watching Michael Jordan play basketball and seeing how he could float through the air, I thought, well, I'm going to do that. And then by 13, I was dunking a basketball already, to everyone's disbelief, even to physical detriments. I was 5'9", 5'10". I'm only about 5'11" now on a stretched out day. And I can almost jump the same height as I stand, because I've always seen myself doing that, because I've seen other people. I'm like, I got to be able to do that. So to me, that's where I was able to manifest that flying. Is not, you know, I don't want to go and be a pilot. I don't want to do this. I just want to be sure that if I have a vision of something, that that vision was sent to me from the universe or from the creator for a reason, that I was supposed to make that happen somehow.
You know, just listening to you, I was reminded of one of the other reasons why I went to airborne school. It's one of the most physically demanding. You know, jumping out of planes is the third week. What you don't see is the first and second week. The waking up at 4:30, by 5 a.m., you're in the middle of an hour of push-ups, crunches, burpees, pull-ups, chin-ups, and then at the end of that hour, Monday to Friday, you have to do a formation run each day, Monday to Friday, for the first 2 weeks. 3-mile run, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it has to be done in under 21 minutes. 7-minute mile
pace,
which for somebody built like me, I was short and stocky with soccer player thighs. You know, that 7-minute mile, 3-mile run was a challenge. So there was part of me looked at jump school as a physical challenge. I've got to prove this to myself, and then I've got to wear that badge when I walk in and take that my first platoon, that they look at me and go, all right, this guy's a stud. Mm-hmm. This guy got through jump school in one piece. He's the real deal. Yeah. So it was a validation of my toughness and my ability to endure the brutally long, hard training days and those hard, hard PT sessions that, quite frankly, every morning, the sergeant major would stand in front of 400 airborne candidates and say, do we have any quitters? And inevitably, five or six guys would come forward. And this is where the mental aspect of the mental overcoming the physical takes over, because the mind, our mind is so much stronger than the body, and the will that we have to just say, there is no way that I'm not gutting my way through this. That's just, failure was just not an option. Mm-hmm. Like, that never entered my mind.
Yep.
To quit, you know, and your lungs are burning, your arms are pumping, and your legs, you know, you feel like you're about to give out, and you're like, there is no way I'm falling out of this run. Just not happening. Mm-hmm.
You have your vision on that goal.
Yeah. But then when you finish something like that, it gives you the confidence then to go through the next challenge. Because in the military, the only easy day was yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yep.
The only easy one is the one that's in the rear view mirror.
Yeah.
Because the next day is going to come fraught with another set of challenges.
Isn't that a metaphor for life?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like life, and specifically our lives. Yeah. Because I always reference, I grew up with Tourette syndrome, and I kind of overcame that, and that had a major aspect, or, you know, help in my healing from the accident, because I had learned already to speak to my cells, to integrate my mind to every cell, to calm it down, and now I needed to wake them back up again. So great point by Bill there. What doesn't break you makes you, literally will make you and prepare you for the future, because when your mind gets to a level where it can continue to move the body after the body stops wanting to move, that stays with you forever. That's not something like conditioning for running that will atrophy after a few months not doing it. As long as your mind knows it can get to that point at some point in its time, it can stay to that point, and you can always get yourself to that point. So I've watched Bill do things that have defied all odds, probably, you know, things that he's been told he would ever be able to do, and he's almost lifting his left arm up to his hand to feed himself and give himself drink and maybe brush his teeth again soon one day. And that is something that, for someone in his injury, you can look this up, should never be a possibility, but it's going to be a possibility, and then we're going to open up new possibilities, because then his mind will become aware of, oh, it just takes extra time, and we can do it. And with that persistence we cultivated in the military back in the day, they used to call him Hammer because he would jackhammer his push-ups out. That same ability to do high repetitions of full range of motion and excel in that is translating to his recovery right now. I can't imagine if he wasn't the Bill who he was before and had these mental systems in order, or trained or cultivated, I don't know who he would be sitting here with me today. Very interestingly. So if it doesn't break you, guys, it's meant to make you exactly who you are. So if you're struggling right now with whatever your goals and dreams are, your physical recovery or mental recovery from something, keep going. Keep stretching your mind's ability to be the power system in your consciousness, in your body, that when your body's ready to give up, let it. Let the mind keep going and pushing you further and taking you to that next limit, because that's going to translate through everything you do the rest of your life.
Well, I think, you know, even just the fact that I was able to breathe again independently. I was never supposed to be able to breathe independently, but part of my recovery was setting the goal to return to teaching. Mm-hmm. Because my drowning and my cardiac arrest that day didn't take away any cognitive ability. So I said, all right, if I can learn to breathe, I can talk. If I can talk, I can teach. if I can teach, my life will have purpose. And so the first step of that was learning to breathe. And it was absolutely brutal. And there would be days where I would try to come off the vent and blow up balloons and fail and break down crying with my speech therapist. And I would get right back at it the next day. And it kept moving. And within 4 months of my injury, I was decannulated, breathing independently ever since. And then 2 years after my injury, I returned to the classroom full time, which was an exercise purely of just will and determination, because I had to relearn how to teach in this body. Mm-hmm. So it was the ultimate exercise in problem solving. You know, how does a man without use of his arms or legs teach? Well, you start with a good person to be your teaching assistant, to be your fingers on the keyboard. But I adapted my room in such a way that the AV people gave me a wireless headset mic and a small speaker to make up for my volume deficits. And all of my lessons and lectures were on PowerPoint. My tests, quizzes, homework, and classwork were all on Word. So the biggest challenge, the testing was easy. The multiple choice were all done on Scantron, run through the machine. But what about essays? How was I going to be able to grade an essay? It would be logistically a nightmare for my TA to hold a piece of paper handwritten while I looked at the words. So I got the computer department to give me a class set on a cart, 30 Chromebook computers, and all the kids wrote their essays in Google Docs, sent them to my Dropbox, and my TA put the essays up on the smart board, and I reclined in my wheelchair every free period. So I really didn't have a free period. My lunch period and my prep periods, I would recline and grade and read essays. And I did it for 2 years. And it took an incredible toll out of me. But at the same time, it brought me literally back to the land of the living. So for your listeners who are struggling, who are suffering, if you're able-bodied and able-minded, just think of the possibilities of what you can overcome.
Yep. And I'm going to say breathe. That's what it comes down to. What saved Bill's life and livelihood and ability to get back into the land of the living, he said, as he said, was working on his breath. And guys, that's the same thing that brought me to any place. If you're like, man, Toby thinks on all these different perspectives I never thought about, that comes from breath. We've said it in past interviews that breath work is the key to unlocking everything: physical endurance, mental ability, calming anxiety, digesting better, dealing with anger. Anything starts with breath work. And we've mentioned, I think it was in the last one or in Wild Moon Co's podcast, if you guys have listened to that, it was all about how almost disassociating with the ego and knowing that we are the most advanced machines on the planet for transforming breath. And breath animates our cells, it gets our neurons firing, it cycles our blood, it also enhances our blood biochemically. So the deeper and more cultivated we work on our breath, everything will start to happen for you around you. And like Bill said, if you're dealing with any stress, anxiety, depression, anything like that, your breath is going to be your best friend. Because think about when your heart rate goes up and you get nervous and anxious, what also goes up? Your respiratory rate. We don't have a way of controlling our hearts, guys, but we can control our breath. And in turn, when we slow our breath down, our heart rate slows down and our ability to deal with reality also improves. You kind of touched upon this. Maybe we'll elaborate a little bit more. Have any of your dreams come true?
From a very earth-based, grounded perspective, all of my dreams came true. And the greatest way that I can say it is that I got myself to a point by my late 20s where I was I was unable to tell the difference between my work and my play.
Beautiful.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because I was teaching 180 days a year with 15 and 16 year olds, and just the pure joy of being able to teach a subject that I loved, and just the pure buzz off of adolescence. And then every Saturday night, going out and playing an Irish wedding where there's 200 people in a catering hall and the dance floor is packed and the band's playing great. So I was, all of my dreams came true because I was not able to tell the difference between my work and my play. And, you know, to live a life like that, isn't that what we'd all aspire to?
Absolutely. You know? That said, transition to the next one. What do you feel is the highest level of human accomplishment?
For me specifically?
For you specifically.
Oh, the thing that I'm... The greatest accomplishment. All right. So, getting back to work was a great one. Being able to breathe again was a great one. But I think the greatest level of human accomplishment is after my wife abandoned me and her family took close to $1 million that was raised for my care. I carried around with me for 2 out of the last 3 years of a pending divorce litigation. I carried around anger and hatred. And as a Christian, I would go to church once or twice a week, and I would be troubled and be vexed by my inability to forgive. And I still can't forgive what they did and the cruelty that she showed to me. A lot of verbal abuse and physical neglect. But in the last year, what I have done, because the anger was too heavy a burden to carry around, I just lay it down. And what it's given me is the light in my soul that I could go out and speak from a place of truth. Because to be angry and hate-filled, you can't speak to people to inspire them. So by laying down that burden, I freed myself to do the work that I'm doing now. And I've spoken to groups from middle school, both public and parochial, high schools, public and parochial, Division I college baseball teams, to corporate affairs, and everywhere I go, the message resonates, and I see people listening with rapt attention and applying it to their own lives. So for me, the greatest human accomplishment that I've had is laying down the burden of my anger. Because, and I heard it said after one of my talks, a woman came up to me and she said, "You know, I love what you said about laying down the burden." And she said, "When you carry such anger and hate around, it's like drinking poison and hoping it kills the person you're angry mm-hmm. at." And I thought, oh my God.
So true. I've heard that. I've seen that written places.
That is genius.
And it does resonate.
Yeah.
So you just spoke about, you know, inspiring so many people and things they've said to you. How do you feel we can inspire other people to not only understand the concept of, you know, laying down the burden of anger or whatever our past is carrying forward in the negative aspect? How do you feel we can inspire other people to let go of that? Because it seems easier said than done type thing, but I personally understand a lot about what you mean and what you've done and how it does free up space in consciousness or in your soul to allow these other things to happen, because it is a heavy, dense energy. Is there a technique you found that makes it easier for you to lay down that burden?
It is the realization, And it can only be, it that there's no pill you can take. There's no quick fix. It is the realization that you build up over time. And it takes, sometimes it could take years. In my case, it took 2 full years to lay down that burden. But it's the realization that the only thing you have any control over is the decision that you make. You can't control the cruelty and the evil that others would do unto you. You have no control over that. All you can control is the decision that you make. And ultimately, you realize, all right, they're never going to ask for my forgiveness. So I have to lay down the burden and free myself. Mm-hmm. Because by being angry, I'm allowing them to keep me shackled.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you're drinking the poison.
I have to free myself.
Correct.
Because they don't want to free me.
Correct.
I have to free myself.
So use it as fuel, guys. Yeah. Well said, Bill. Thank you so much. That is the end of my questioning for the day.
Wow,
I'm really, really grateful for your perspective and the life you've lived and continue to live. And guys, all of the people we've had on so far are going to be major successes in their fields. I think you can sense that. I think you can see that manifesting around them. This is no offense to Vin, Missy, Dina, Gatsby, anybody that's been on before, but I've always seen Bill since I met him as this motivational speaker, almost being like the Oprah of this modern generation, right? We went through the 80s and 90s. Everybody was trying to earn all this money. So we admired people that had become billionaires independently and had done this. And we wanted to listen to these people and see what they had to say. But look around you. Look how many people are struggling from opiate addictions to coming back from wartime, missing limbs or being severely maimed and having to restructure their reality. And as a result, you have to restructure your reality around this struggle that they've been through or you're going through. We are currently in the generation, as Bill said earlier, where there's a lot of chaos on our planet. And that's what we seem to perceive. So to see somebody and to know somebody exists like Billy Keenan, who is growing in his platforms and who he's reaching and how many people and the degrees that they're sharing the awareness of this gentleman and his story. This is what we need in the future. I mean, I have always, in a sense, identified with my accident because it's allowed me to become who I am and have this drive and purpose I have, but it was reignited the moment I met Billy and began to work at Push to Walk in general, but Bill specifically has inspired me to a degree that nobody in my life thus far has been able to inspire me, because I was always the experienced one. I was always the one out there inspiring others, and I came across a guy who had so much light shining from his eyes when I met him, in the smile and his personality and how open he is to just helping other people and opening their perspectives to you can do this and things are going to get better. Guys, you got to look him up. BillyKeenanSpeaks.org. Go to his Facebook. Get on YouTube. If you see anything on YouTube, subscribe.
Billy Keenan Speaks.
Billy Keenan Speaks.
Is my YouTube channel.
On YouTube. So go subscribe immediately after you hear this. Watch all the videos. Listen to everything he has to say. You are going to save your life or save someone that you care about's life for the better and improve it for the better just by listening to this guy. I want to thank Billy again. Billy, thank you for being here.
I enjoyed this. Awesome. It was thoroughly enjoyable.
Thank you.
And my very first podcast.
Look at that. I'm getting everybody's first. So you guys are going to hear a lot more to come from Billy. Please tune in to The Art of Flying on all platforms that offer podcasting, from Apple Music to Spotify and anything in between. Thank you, guys. I'm going to post a little video on YouTube later so you get a visual of Billy, and you guys will have all the links underneath that video to find him on all his social media platforms. So thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your story one day.